1039 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. It is Feltus and Kale for March 4th. And Dan, we're going to march forth with yet another radio extravaganza here.
That was great, Ken. That was a terrific pun.
That's Republican humor right there.
Right, you got it.
Right, yeah. You always kind of intersperse your Democratic humor. Once in a while, I will say something that, I will attempt humor, but very rarely succeed at it. But we have a very interesting guest today, and I've had Anna on my radio shows over the years. Anna Brown from Citizens Count. She will be our guest today. Citizens Count, a great organization. Anna will tell us more about that as we march forth here. Feltus and Kale, 1039 1450 WKXL. NHTalkRadio.com. Feltus and Kale at 1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. And as promised, our guest today is Anna Brown. She is the Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count. And Anna, how are you today?
Lots of sunshine and as many people, I'm working from home, and it does not appear that my neighbors are doing construction or watching telenovelas or blaring hip-hop. So, hey, man, it's above average. It's a good day.
Well, that's good. That's good. Any day that's above average is an outstanding day. And, Anna, for the benefit of those people who haven't heard any of our radio chats in the past, just briefly tell us what Citizens Count is all about.
Citizens Count is a nonpartisan nonprofit that is dedicated to providing unbiased information on New Hampshire issues and candidates. Our website is going to have profiles for everyone who is a current elected official and running for office, from state rep all the way up to the president. There was a presidential race this past year, of course. And then we're going to be tracking bills. Fun fact, we recently launched a podcast. It's called $100 Plus Mileage. It covers lesser-known New Hampshire issues that might not get a lot of news coverage, but still could impact you. So we dig into things from tiny houses to home distilling and talk about the pros and cons and how you can get involved.
I love the poll questions, and we'll talk more about those later. But that always attracts me to the Citizens Count Facebook page or those poll questions because they are so diverse.
Yes, we're always trying to highlight, there's roughly 900 bills in the New Hampshire legislature each year. So there's plenty of issues to talk about and get people's opinions.
No doubt about that. And how is Citizens Count funded?
We are a nonprofit, and we will accept a donation from anyone, dollar on up. Feel free to hit us up. We got to put that plug in there. We are very lucky to also have some sponsors that have no say over our content, but you will notice if you visit our website, we have a sponsor bar that features their logos. And that was a decision so that we wouldn't have to have paid advertising on the website, because we know that it would be a nightmare if you went to visit a candidate's page and supposed to find unbiased information, and then suddenly you're getting a pop-up ad about someone else who's running for the same office.
Exactly, and as you said, you have bios of all the state reps, all the state senators. And I know you keep a close eye on things going on at the State House. I'm sure Dan Feltus is sorely missed under the Golden Dome these days.
Well, my goodness, it's such an exciting year already in the State Senate. They have so much going on. They're voting on bills today. And I know that Senator Feltus is probably still getting involved, just like anyone in New Hampshire can, testifying at those hearings. Hey, virtual testimony this year. You can testify by Zoom, so, just make sure you have on your Zoom blazer and the cat doesn't walk on the keyboard and you're good to go.
Exactly.
Very true. And that really points out that this has got to be the most unusual start to a legislative session in really anyone's memory, for sure.
I tell you what, I can't think of a weirder year for the legislature. And we've had some strange things happen. I remember a few years back, former Speaker Bill O'Brien was teed up to get reelected, and then you had Gene Chandler come out of the wings. It was a total surprise. He worked with Democrats and a minority of Republicans to get the speakership. But little things like that don't compare at all to the, frankly, nightmare that we've had to deal with in terms of how do you get 400 state representatives together, secure, safe, logistically possible. So they've been trying, they tried the drive-in session where it was basically like a drive-in movie theater. They tried the Sportsplex in Bedford, which is basically they're spread across a giant indoor football field. And they have yet to try the virtual, but there is a lawsuit pending right now that is headed up by the minority leader, Rep. Brenny Cushing. And so I know that it's, you know, still possible that they might win their case and that they would end up having a virtual session as well. And then, I don't know, maybe that's the triple crown of House of Representatives meetings. You know, you have the drive-in, the in-person, and the virtual. Who knows?
Well, I wanted to chat about that, Anna. This is Dan. So, you know, that lawsuit now going to the First Circuit is strictly for folks with impairments or disabilities or conditions that, you know, prevent them from going in person, period. And the requested accommodation was rejected by the speaker that to do just remote for those persons. The district court judge in New Hampshire rejected that claim. It's going to the First Circuit. How is that affecting the atmosphere in the House in particular, that contention over remote versus not remote?
I think that we are seeing incredible tension and hyper-partisanship, and it's just, it's not a good thing, if I'm going to be honest. And so a couple interesting details there. Before the coronavirus pandemic ever hit, there's one measure of partisanship that I track, and it's called the party unity score. And to be clear, there's a lot of different ways you can measure partisanship. The party unity score is just looking at how often does the majority of one party vote against the majority of the other party. So basically you have that line in the sand and there's not a lot of overlap. And that has been going up consistently for the past 20 years, hit a high before the coronavirus. And I was kind of hoping that maybe the coronavirus would kick us out of that, you know, would start a different trend, but it really made it worse because it's turned out that just the forum itself, how they are meeting, is so contentious because there's this feeling that it's not just sort of procedural, that it's literally, I don't want to speak for Democrats as a monolith, right? Because we have hundreds of different Democratic representatives who have their own personal experiences and views, but I'm also going to tease out a couple individual stories. So we spoke about Minority Leader Rep. Brenny Cushing. Okay, he has stage 4 cancer, and so now he has to choose between going in person and leading his party and representing his constituents, and at the same time protecting his health. What sort of risks is he taking? He obviously falls into that high-risk category.
Right.
So it creates this sensation that it's...
Anna, are you there? We seem to have lost Anna Brown, and I'm sure Anna will call back. She was talking about a lot of interesting aspects of this year's legislative session under the Golden Dome, but lots of times not under the Golden Dome because, you know, the legislature has had remote sessions as she mentioned, at the Bedford Sports Complex, drive-in movie theater, and so it's really been a very unusual year. And Anna, are you back with us?
I am.
All
I
right.
am.
Okay.
Well, Anna,
so I was just going to say that. So then, also, even meeting in person, the way it was spaced out, whether it was intentional or it was just impossible to hear in such that sports arena, you know, there was a sensation that the speaker was not even seeing or acknowledging Democratic reps who were making motion on the floor. So
yeah,
the format itself is definitely increasing partisanship.
Yeah, and obviously I think that, you know, if you have a severe impairment, severe medical condition, if you can be accommodated with remote voting, I just respectfully disagree with the district court judge in New Hampshire, and we'll see what this First Circuit does. But and I'm also concerned about... you know, when I was serving there for 3 terms, you know, we'd sit down and, you know, myself, Senator Bradley, others, a lot of bipartisan work where you sit down around a table, you iron things out. In the Zoom and strictly Zoom and phone call environment, I just don't think, I don't get the feeling that that kind of relationship building and that kind of work together is really as possible, and that I worry that it leads to more, you know, fights, less problem solving. Are you sensing that?
It's interesting that you bring that up because that's actually something that on our kind of in the background at Citizens Count we've looked at over the years, because our goal as an organization is to increase the quality and the amount of civic dialogue in New Hampshire as a whole. And we are online. We're primarily a website. We use Facebook and Twitter and these other tools. And we've seen that when you put computers between people, there's something that happens, and it's a sociological thing, it's a psychological thing, whatever it is, it sort of dehumanizes the other person, and it does seem like you're less likely to have those personal connections. You also aren't going to have those moments where you run into each other in a coffee shop or the hallways or the cafeteria in the basement of the state house, and you see that's that other person, and you have that whole relationship. It becomes the only time you're seeing each other, maybe, is these highly partisan moments. And yeah, it's concerning for the future of our dialogue and our civil relationships.
Did you ever think you would see the day when we came to segregated parking areas in the state of New Hampshire for state reps?
I know. I never saw that one coming. I that was one of the things about the Sportsplex that really surprised me, the fact that he had completely separate entrances and parking for Democrats and Republicans. And I mean, I get it on one hand, right? Because a lot of the Democrats were saying, you know, it's people in the other party. It's Republicans who are not wearing masks or not following whatever safety protocols. So on the one hand, you know, maybe that was a way to decrease tensions. But yeah, it's not, it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good when literally the same parties can't walk through the same door.
Anna, your measure of partisanship, I presume, is based on roll call votes. Is that right?
It is. And so in case listeners don't know, a roll call vote is when the legislators have to put their vote next to their name. And there are other votes that happen in the legislature, for example, voice votes, where it's just, are the yays louder than the nays, basically. There's also another vote called a division vote where everybody presses their button, you get like the count, but you don't know whose name goes with which vote. So yes, we're just looking at roll call votes. And it is possible. Someone pointed out once, okay, well, are we still, you know, maybe there's just more voice votes, or maybe there's just more roll call votes, you know, that could be impacting it. But we found that when we were looking at that, that wasn't making a huge difference. There were more roll call votes over time, and those votes were also getting more partisan.
Yeah, and I mean, I haven't done a deep dive in it, but just at least in my experience serving in the state Senate, typically where there is, you know, bipartisan unity on a particular piece of legislation, even if it's controversial, typically it's voice vote. Sometimes there'll be a roll call just to show the unity of 24-0, which we did on Children's System of Care and some other stuff, you know, in the last session. But, you know, the roll call votes, generally speaking, at least from my experience, were the ones where there was a difference of opinion and largely breaking out based on party. Is there any way to dig into those voice votes to add that as part of the context to a description of party unity? Probably not, but just...
Well, what we can look at is we can look at the number of bills that had any roll call vote versus just had voice votes.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it's a lot of bills will just... they'll either pass or they'll get killed just because everyone seems to agree it's a good or bad idea.
Right.
So when we did look at that last time around, and I haven't updated that data yet for this year, I've just been peeking. We'll do a full update at the end of the session, probably in June or July. But when we looked at it last year, it was that the number of voice votes compared to the number of roll call votes was decreasing. So basically, fewer votes were happening that were just completely bipartisan, or assumed to be mostly bipartisan.
Anna, in your role, and you know, as serving a nonprofit, providing this information to the public, digging into these issues, you interface with the media to some extent. And you know, one of my concerns, and Ken and I have talked about this on the show, is to the extent that the media is under-resourced, not able to dig into issues, it seems as though you may be filling some of that void. Which is a good thing. However, on the flip side, do you see the media really digging into issues, or is it more surface level, he said, she said, on a particular issue?
I think that there are a couple things that are happening here that unfortunately are really making it more, as you said, he said, she said, soundbite. So the first thing is, across the country, and Pew Research did a study on this a few years ago, across the country, the number of reporters dedicated to what's going on at the state level, state house reporters, is declining. And this is also true in New Hampshire. So you have less local coverage. And this is partly because of the advent of the internet. People can get their news from whatever large national companies, and they're just going to them as an easy source. So then your local newspapers, people are less interested in paying for that paper subscription. It's a real challenge for local news. So that's one thing. You're just losing out on coverage. And then on another level, we're seeing the impact of social media in particular, where more controversial articles and quick headlines are getting interaction, they're getting reach. It's sort of creating this reward cycle where it's easy for the public to just be scrolling through, see something that they have a knee-jerk reaction to, it gets lots of clicks, it gets lots of views, and so then news companies have a motivation to keep on producing that sort of content. It's such a difficult situation, and so I feel like it's interesting in Citizens Count in our role over the past few years, I've had to sort of start rethinking it, because it becomes not just, okay, being a resource of, for unbiased information, particularly candidate profiles, and thinking more, we need to start filling this void of, frankly, less clickbaity state house coverage. You know, focusing on these bills that unfortunately there's just not enough people to cover, but they're happening. I think that the danger of focusing on these clickbait topics, these highline articles, is that people are losing out on the democracy that is still working, that is still happening in New Hampshire. Because there is a lot of that. Let's be real. It's very easy to focus on all the challenges, especially this year, my goodness. And then we had those really controversial votes on abortion restrictions last week, which huge partisan fighting. But let's not remember, there were dozens of other bills that did also get voted on that day. Dozens of bill hearings every single day. And that business is going forward.
Anna Brown is our guest, and Anna is Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count. You can find them on Facebook at Citizens Count and the website, citizenscount.org. And you guys are so well-versed in what's going on in the state, and shamefully, I'm certainly not as well-versed. But what are some of the major issues that are on the docket, Anna, for this legislative session?
One topic that has been getting a lot of attention is school funding in general. On one hand, you have Commissioner Frank Edelblue from the Department of Education, who's really pushing and advocating for a sort of school voucher program. It's not called that in the legislation. That's sort of a shorthand for it, but basically allowing parents to take the per pupil state funding and dedicate it to private or homeschooling. On the other hand, we just had a commission that studied school funding for a year, and they're looking at changing the entire formula for how that happens in New Hampshire. We know that there's been lawsuits and, oh my gosh, so many problems. For over two decades, New Hampshire really hasn't resolved how can we fairly provide an adequate education for every student. That's a big issue. Also, it's a budget year. So we're dealing with really weird coronavirus revenues, but Governor Sununu and Republicans are really pushing for a business tax cut. And so that's going to be a big debate. Lesser known issues that I think maybe are going to start bubbling up because they're sort of, they've been overshadowed a little bit by the budget and the school funding so far, but absentee voting, voter ID, issues like that. There are many bills. They're going to have a couple hearings today, tomorrow, Monday, that are going to require more identification if you're voting absentee, or expanding absentee voting so you can do the no excuse even after the coronavirus. Different auditing for after you vote and what happens with absentee ballots, when they're processed. So that's an issue. Voting in general is going to be big, I think. And then finally, affordable housing. Not sexy. So complex. I mean, really hard to write a quick hit article or clickbait on that one. But we all know, I think, that New Hampshire is in a housing crisis. My goodness, the inventory has just completely contracted, and it was already low. Prices are skyrocketing. And that just is a domino effect on all sorts of other issues. Getting workforce into New Hampshire, keeping young people after they graduate college, and helping people stay in their homes when a primary source of income in the state is property taxes. If property values keep on going up and up and up, it's going to price out people who have been paying property taxes for decades. So that's kind of what I see as the hot issues.
And to the last issue, Anna, glad you mentioned it. I mean, we worked in the legislature over the last 6 years, made some progress with accessory dwelling units, first ever recovery housing appropriation and development, first, you know, ongoing sustainable Affordable Housing Fund appropriation to the Affordable Housing Fund, which leverages private and federal money to develop the supply of affordable housing in the state. And Senator Bradley, myself, and others worked on that. Where do you see this in this session? What are the, I think there's a bill in the House to do an incentive, some incentives, and maybe rework some of the municipal zoning to some degree. And that, I think that got tabled. Is that right? And if, and in addition to that, is there any other initiative right now?
So there are several bills going through that are different combinations of tax incentives for developers or to have towns expand revitalization districts that would have special tax breaks. There's also movement to increase funding for the Affordable Housing Fund, which will just basically, you know, help subsidize, provide loans for affordable housing developments in the state. And then there's that final layer of zoning laws and if, you know, town officials can either be educated on how to change laws to welcome affordable housing or if there needs to be some other state incentive to change or mandate to change zoning. So the bill that's really interesting, it was HB 586. It was a package that combined several of these different approaches. If you're looking at, you want incentives, you want training for local officials, et cetera. It was, had support of Governor Sununu, and it was tabled in the House over what I would boil down to local control concerns. I'm sure you're both very familiar in New Hampshire, the phrase local control sort of, it's almost like a secondary state motto. I think that people get really fired up about it if you're looking at school issues or, in this case, zoning issues. And so there was concern that, oh, this is going to start taking away local control of zoning. And the point of the bill, right after it was tabled, it came back really quickly and said, no, this is just options. This is not, these are not mandates for towns. But that was a bit of a surprise since it did have the support of Sununu, and it made me think that, all right, maybe affordable housing bills are going to have an uphill battle this year.
Well, certainly, you know, bumping up against that argument, you're absolutely right that that mantra of local control it was something that permeated. Interestingly enough, we're not a home rule state. You know, we got a towns and cities only have what's delegated to them. It kind of cross cuts. But setting aside the actual dealing with either incentives or mandates on local communities, what is the initiative to help with the Affordable Housing Fund? We did that in the last budget, ongoing stabilized at least $5 million per year. Is there an effort to bolster that to 10 or 15 per year?
So this, I mean, yes, there's one, if I remember correctly, I believe HB 586, and of course now I'm going to hesitate because I don't have it right in front of me, and there are many, as I said, there are many different affordable housing bills. So I don't actually, I think that was not HB 586, but it was, I believe there are several other bills that would increase it, just $10 million over 2 years that rings a bell. I think that that was one of the proposals I saw. But the other thing here is part of the reason why I haven't paid attention to which specific bills are specifying which amount is it's the budget year. And so we all know that ultimately where this funding goes, where it comes from, is going to get really wrapped up in that state budget debate.
Anna Brown is with us, and Anna is the Director of Research and Analysis for Citizens Count. Citizens Count on Facebook and citizenscount.org. They will accept contributions. Anna assured us of that earlier in the program. We're going to take a quick break right here and be back with Anna Brown. Feltus and Kale, 1039 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. Feltus and Kale on this March 4th, Anna Brown with us from Citizens Count. And we mentioned at the top of the show, Anna, it's always fun to go on to the Citizens Count Facebook page to see the poll questions. As you mentioned, there are so many bills, you know, in the legislature, and you highlight many of them in your poll questions. Let me mention just a few of your recent ones and the reaction that you got from your followers and the people who contribute their comments. Most recently, and you alluded to this earlier, you asked about House Bill 61. In simplest terms, that bill it concerns when local officials can start processing absentee ballots and would generally expand absentee voting. What was the reaction to that poll question, Anna?
I think that one thing that's a little unfortunate now is the issue of absentee voting has just got completely wrapped up into this sort of crazy national wild debate, which frankly does not have a lot of basis in what happens in New Hampshire and what goes on in New Hampshire. Among other things, New Hampshire isn't just mailing everyone a ballot. You have to be a voter. You can track your ballot where it goes through the system. But, you know, what we're seeing is that there's a lot of backlash and skepticism and dare I say, hostility towards expanding absentee voting because of all the false claims of that the election was stolen or that there was a big conspiracy, which there hasn't been any proof of that whatsoever. But it was, you know, I would like to put the best bit on it, which is that people cherish the sanctity of our elections, and they cherish our democracy, and they want to know that it's secure and it's safe. But on the other side of the debate, you do have a lot of people who say, you know, honestly, voting from home during the coronavirus pandemic was a lot more convenient. It was a lot easier. And we did see record high turnout in the 2020 elections, right? So it does seem that giving people that option, if it's secure, can be a really good way to increase democratic participation.
Any thoughts on that, Dan?
Well, I think that what we saw is, as Anna mentioned, pretty much record participation in the last election cycle. And I think that what we need to do is continue to include more people in our democracy, have more voices at the table, and not put up barriers. And so these are just common sense efforts to move forward to make sure that people have the right to access to the ballot. So, I mean, I think that historically, and you know, at least in the last session, we were able to get agreement on a limited mail-in option for the pandemic. But in the past, mail-in options, universal mail-in, no excuse absentee ballot, had been vetoed, including by Governor Sununu. I think that what we'll see as this plays out is more and more contention on this. And you've seen legislation, SB3, House Bill 1264, that throw up barriers. And Anna, I think, you know, we talked about contentiousness. I think, you know, this issue, voting rights, is so contentious. And we're seeing that even New Hampshire is on the list of states being monitored nationwide for this voting suppression legislation. And how do you interface with some of these national groups that monitor either voting rights issues or some of these other issues? And how do you determine what information maybe you repost or provide from some of those groups?
We have always been New Hampshire focused and just really trying to focus on New Hampshire. So I will be completely honest. We have not pursued sort of relationships or even just like retweeting or promoting national viewpoints or anything like that on pretty much any issue. I think that when we're teasing out what's going on here, when you're looking at those tighter voter restrictions or alternatively opening it up, letting more people access the ballot, we're just trying to focus on, okay, what is the reality here in New Hampshire? Because there is just so much national rhetoric, and I think it's easy for the average voter who's just getting bombarded with whatever from Facebook and the national news to forget that every state is going to have a unique voting system. They're going to administer their own elections. The details are going to be different. And so I think that from my perspective at Citizens Count, I feel like my goal is to educate people about what actually happens in New Hampshire, because I'm sure that they're getting bombarded with things about Dominion voting machines or ballot drop-off boxes and things like that, that that doesn't really have a strong relationship with the debates that are happening in New Hampshire.
And Anna, you and Ken had talked about you may get to this in just a second with Ken, but the poll questions, if you will, that you put on your Facebook page, obviously, the response is maybe not as scientific as an actual poll, but nevertheless, setting aside those questions, I assume you get emails and outreach from people who want to ask you questions about specific issues. And do you monitor what kind of organic input and questions come to you? And if so, what are the issues that are really bubbling to the top in terms of that organic input?
We do get just one-off emails or Facebook messages or anything like that about specific bills coming through. And honestly, if I just go over like the past week in my head, there have been two issues that have come up more than once. We've got a few different people that have reached out directly on that. One of the issues was actually related to how the property tax applies to RVs, and I'm still looking into that. It appears that maybe there was a change in some sort of state regulation, we've had a couple people saying, my RV wasn't taxed, now they're saying it's going to be taxed, and the RV property tax issue is another one that doesn't get a lot of playtime, but seems to impact a lot of people, so I'm still looking into that. And then the other one that we've gotten a few direct emails that people seem kind of fired up about is what happened with the Wyndham recount. And to just do a quick recap for people who might not be up to speed, in Wyndham, there was a really tight race, and so there was a recount, and there is roughly a 300-vote discrepancy between what happened and what they found in the results in the recount and what they originally had from the election. And so 300 may not sound like a lot to some people, but it's much larger than the usual margin of error when there is a recount. So the state's attorney general's office has been looking into that. And then also there is a bill that has a hearing tomorrow. In fact, it already passed the Senate, and it would authorize an audit of that race. Because the way state law works, and I think that overall this is a good thing, state election ballots are very tightly protected. You can't just go rifling through them. You know, you can't just wander around with the boxes. It's all sealed. You know, there's an election. They're secure. They can only be pulled out very specifically for that recount. So the House is now going to be having a public hearing on this bill, which the Senate already passed, that would just basically allow them to take those ballots back out of the box and do another recount, and another recount with the machines as well as by hand, to see, all right, was it human error? What happened? Because the machines themselves, they go through testing before the election. They're sealed. They're put in the vault. You know, it's not like anybody can just hack their way into the machines. They aren't connected to the internet. But, you know, they do get old. So the question is, like, was there some weird problem with the machines? Or, in my personal opinion, slightly more likely, was there some sort of human error in terms of counting a packet of ballots twice or forgetting or not putting them through, something like that? So that's the issue that we've actually seen the most emails on in the past week.
Hmm. Going back to House Bill 61, I think there's a hearing on that today. Is that correct?
House Bill 61, let me pull it up. It was today, or it might be Monday. I should have had that
okay.
open since
no,
we were talking
no
about it earlier.
But
I'm looking it up.
Yeah. But
It was. You're right. Today at 9:30 a.m.
Okay. All right. But I personally feel, and you can comment on this or not, as long as there are elongated voting periods, there is going to be skepticism among a lot of people, whether it's justified or not. People are going to think there's more time for hanky-panky. The longer the voting period exists, people are going to have the impression, and maybe those seeds were planted during this last election, but people are going to have the impression that there's, you know, something a little amiss going on. That's the way I feel about it.
It's interesting you bring that up, because part of HB 61 and several other bills, in fact, is when you can start processing absentee ballots, which seems like such a administrative minute issue, but it directly touches on what you're talking about. And we actually had one of our podcast episodes about this. If people want to go to our website, click on the podcast on the homepage, and they can find the episode. Basically, the current law is that election officials can only start processing, literally opening the envelopes, even absentee ballots, the day of the election. And so, because there were so many more absentee ballots expected this year, there was a special law that allowed them to start opening those ballots a few days early. And so that is one of the reasons why New Hampshire got its results pretty much election night or Wednesday morning. It was good to go. And then you compare that to other states where there were these huge controversies. And, yeah, people got so fired up. They were, you know, the whole stop the steal, I believe, was one of the chants. And I think it was, as you say, it's largely because the result wasn't in yet. They were still counting it. It just creates this sort of, frenzy, because people, without that certain quick result. So I think that the when of when you can start counting absentee ballots seems minor, but is actually a very important issue when you're looking at the validity of election results.
One of the other bills that is up this year is, and you kind of alluded to this one as well, Anna, a few minutes ago, HB 588. Should New Hampshire require towns to allow tiny houses? We were talking about housing a little while ago. Are there places where tiny houses are banned right now?
The problem is New Hampshire does not have any sort of statewide guidelines on are tiny houses okay or not. It's going to go town by town, and it's going to depend on their specific zoning regulations and if they're going to allow certain variances, et cetera. So that's actually, we have a podcast episode on that as well. We did it just a little while ago. And the tiny house debate is interesting because on the one hand, this tiny house movement, it's eco-friendly, it's less expensive. This might be a way to really open up affordable housing in New Hampshire, maybe attract some younger workers to the state who don't, you know, need that huge house. But there's also, on the other hand, the question of, okay, local control, like should, if the state comes in and says every town has to allow tiny houses, we're getting back up against that local control debate. And also, I think there is concern that, all right, if we have affordable housing problem, is the solution to just let people live in tinier and tinier and tinier spaces? Or is the solution that we need to have a more affordable normal housing as well? So that's an interesting debate. And we were surprised when we put that out there. We had way more interest, you know, clicks and listens than we were necessarily expecting. So I think that for whatever reason, whether it's people browsing cute little tiny houses on Pinterest or if it really is serious interest in this issue, that one might end up being a surprisingly hot debate.
Tiny houses, big debate, Ken and Anna.
But, you know, if you have a plot of land, say you own a plot of land and you want to build a tiny house, could a city or town stop that at this point in time?
Yes. Yes, they could choose because right now different towns might have for different requirements in terms of how big certain rooms are, a minimum size for buildings. I know that even when you're looking at detached accessory dwelling units, towns don't necessarily have to allow those. And if they do allow them, they can set their own minimum dimensions. So sort of the poster child case for this was a young woman from Hampton Falls, New Hampshire, and she was trying to live in a tiny house on her parents' property, and the Zoning Board of Adjustment ultimately denied her occupancy permit and denied her appeals for various reasons about, you know, how it was hooked up to systems and what sizes it was. So she was forced to abandon her tiny house, and that's a fact for a lot of tiny house people that I've read about, is the idea that they're so concerned about running up against these town regulations and getting shut down that they actually try to live under the radar. They, you know, it's not like they want to live illegally off the grid, but that they're more just like they have their housing situation that they like, and they don't want to raise the attention of town officials either way.
And this was a big debate actually out in Warner within, you know, WKXL's listening area. Anna, but the bigger debate and what certainly was brought up routinely in terms of municipal regulation was density restrictions. In other words, you can only have 5 units per acre or whatever, and that would de facto prohibit multifamily and multi-unit, whether senior or multifamily development within a municipality. I believe Senator Rebecca Perkins Cuoco might have a bill on density issues. And can you update us if you're aware of where the debate on density restrictions is right now?
I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to have to plead ignorance. I know that there are bills that touch on that, but I don't want to pretend to be an expert on that right now when I'm not.
Sure.
Is this tiny house thing, is it really taking off? I mean, are there a lot being constructed in New Hampshire? I honestly don't know.
Well, I feel like part of the problem is that since these people are often living under the radar, it can be hard to measure the scale of it.
Yeah.
And I know that there have been some people who have expressed interest in building tiny house parks where you have several tiny homes on the same property using potentially the same utilities. And some of those have got shut down. And then, of course, we had the really unfortunate situation over in Peterborough where there was this little cottage community, and that got shut down recently not necessarily because tiny houses just in general were, you know, violating zoning, but because unfortunately the property manager, property owner who had set all this up had just completely violated all sorts of safety codes. And it from every story I've read, it frankly really sucks to be one of the people who was living there because, you know, they had no idea that he was breaking all sorts of laws and safety codes, and now they're without their homes.
And just all goes to the diversity of the questions on the Citizens Count Facebook page.
Yeah,
I mean, they go from the most controversial issues to some that aren't quite as controversial. But you always, Anna, you can always count on some very interesting feedback from the folks that follow your Facebook page. It's fun to read.
Oh, yeah.
Really, it's a fun read. I know there was, you know, a question up there about allowing Puerto Rico to become a state and. You know, it a lot of questions, and it's always a lot of fun. But just in the brief moments we have left, just tell us about the fledgling podcast career that you have embarked on.
Yes. So $100 plus mileage is the name of the podcast, and this is actually a partnership podcast with the Granite State News Collaborative, which is a great organization. New Hampshire newspapers coming together to cover some important topics in the state. And also, it's being produced by students at Franklin Pierce University. So major shout out to them. Citizens Count could not be doing this on our own. So our goal is to tease out some of these lesser known issues, like we were talking about tiny houses, also one that I'm sure some people are just going to scratch their heads over. But microblading eyebrows, actually, it's a whole occupational licensing issue in New Hampshire. And you have to have a tattoo license. Should that change? Hobby distilling, I mentioned. We talked about absentee voting, another issue that we touched on today. When can you start processing those ballots? So our goal is to sort of make New Hampshire policy a little entertaining, talk about how these issues really can relate to you and how you can get involved. My hope is by focusing on some of these lesser-known issues that aren't the, you know, hot clickbait debates, we can remind people that there's a lot of democracy happening in New Hampshire, and you can get involved. You can make a difference. You know, don't get sucked into the nightmares that are happening in Washington and lose faith in your institutions. You know, this can happen near you, and, you know, hopefully you get some laughs along the way.
And where can you find it, the podcast?
So we are on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, $100 plus mileage, and also really easy if you go to the Citizens Count homepage. Right at the top, we have a lovely yellow box that says New Podcast. You can click right there, and that'll give you all the links as well.
Very good. Well, Anna, always a delight to have you, and we'll have you back real soon. Thanks so much for your insight.
Thanks, Anna.
Thanks so much, Feltus and Kale.
All right. Thanks, Anna. Feltus and Kale will continue. We'll wrap things up. We're heading down the home stretch here on this Thursday, March 4th, 103.9, 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. 1039 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. Kale here and Feltus. It's Feltus and Kale. Sometimes I get confused because probably I fall back to an old show I used to do where my name was first. But nonetheless, it's Feltus and Kale here on WKXL. We're on twice a week, folks. Tell your neighbors and friends that we have two new shows every week at 11:05 on Tuesday and 11:05. On Thursday.
That's right.
And who knows? We could even be expanded more.
It was a surprise that, you know, our contract was extended to 2 days a week, Ken. People are listening all around the world. They really are.
Today is Marching Music Day, by the way.
Really?
I really miss, you know, the staple. You know, when I was first following the old Boston Patriots, this is how old I am. Back in the 1960s, they played some at Fenway Park, some at Harvard Stadium, Boston College as well. They were kind of an orphan team, the Boston Patriots. But they always had marching bands at halftime, you know, much as they do high school games and college games. But I
like a good marching band.
Marching band is great. I like the UConn Huskies marching band, which I think is great. My daughter was a part of that for a while down at the University of Connecticut, and I'm sure the Hawkeyes have a great marching band, too.
They've got a heck of a marching band. They really do.
In Iowa. Yeah, I'm sure they do. All right, Dan, I'm going to ask you a personal question now.
Sure.
Today is also National Snack day.
Oh, boy.
What's your favorite snack?
Oh, favorite snack? I would say cashews.
Cashews. That's good. That's a good
open
snack.
Open up some cashews. And
healthy.
It's healthy. It's healthy.
Unless, you know, there's too much salt on it, but for the most part.
Yeah, what about you?
It's healthy. I kind of like Cheez-Its, actually.
Cheez-Its are great. That's a great pick. And they came out with this new, more toasted Cheez-Its.
Oh, yes. Oh, I love that.
That's tasty.
I love that. Well, I'm glad we're on the same page. Yeah. Feldis and Kale, it's always great to have you with us. And join us again next time here on 103.9 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com.